as a history geek, I'm saddened to read the State Journal's account of yesterday's demolition of the old Arbaugh House next to Lansing Community College. That was at 205 East Saginaw. The home was built more than a century ago for Frank Arbaugh, the successful Lansing retailer from decades ago. According to Matt Miller's account, LCC was all but giving the house away, but a plan to move the Arbaugh House fell apart. LCC needs to expand. Goodbye, Arbaugh House. Some Lansing preservationists give LCC credit for waiting more than a year for a plan to save the house to emerge, and it had become scarred by neglect, I think was the words in the story, in recent years, but it's gone. Too bad. Later this hour, on a more positive note, a taste of this week's send-off party for the Lansing area's five young competitors in the U.S. Figure Skating Championships. They're off to Boston to compete. At the top of our program today, by the year 2020, the Association of American Medical Colleges predicts the U.S. will be short more than 45,000 primary care physicians. With the likely influx of hundreds of thousands of new patients due to the Affordable Care Act, not to mention the aging baby boomer generation, this shortage has the potential to wreak havoc on our healthcare system over the next decade. Here to discuss the primary care physician shortage and give us a sense of how this is playing out here in Michigan is Dr. Julie Phillips. Julie's an associate professor of family medicine at MSU's College of Human Medicine and leads the Family Medicine Clerkship here in Lansing. Welcome to Current State, Julie.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
There have been plenty of articles alluding to a shortage in primary care physicians nationwide. What's your sense of the situation here in Michigan?
I definitely see the effects of the primary care physician shortage here in Michigan, in our state, especially in more rural communities and some of our underserved urban communities.
You see it now, or this is something you're anticipating?
Oh, I see it now. I see it now, although I do anticipate that it'll get worse. I definitely see the consequences now in my own work.
Mm. And how do you see those? How does that play out on a day-to-day basis?
Well, the main issue is that it's very hard for patients to get access to primary care physicians. Mm-hmm. It's hard for them to get into primary care physicians, especially patients who have insurance that reimburses at lower levels, like some of the county health plans and the Medicaid programs.
And is it an issue more in rural areas than in urban, as you said earlier?
Absolutely. The shortage is worse in rural communities, although it affects almost every community in the state.
It's so interesting because we had the head of the Michigan League for Public Policy on yesterday, and we got to talking about how lack of services and hardship is really it's so concentrated geographically. Lake County, all the way up in the Keweenaw Peninsula of Michigan, apparently finishes dead last in this is the Kids Count survey. I don't know if you're familiar with this or not, but it finishes dead last in about 5 of 15 different measures that they take in the Kids Count survey. So I would imagine a place like Lake County is struggling with primary care physicians as well.
I would imagine so too, although I don't know the specifics for that county.
But
certainly most of our rural counties in Michigan have a shortage. And actually, there's only a few counties in Michigan that have an adequate number of primary care physicians. Most counties are in a shortage situation. It's just a difference of degree, but it is worse in rural communities, definitely.
How much worse do you expect this to get?
Well, there's some evidence that the primary care physician workforce probably will not even replace itself over the next couple of decades, because most of our primary care physicians, many of them are older and are planning to retire soon, and medical student interest in primary care is very low right now.
Now, does the way that people use our healthcare system factor in here?
To a certain extent, it does.
How?
Well, when people can't see primary care physicians, they're more likely to get care in emergency rooms, and they're more likely to be hospitalized when they don't have access to primary care. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, there's a preference for specialists. You know, there's a perception that specialty care is better. in truth, both primary care and specialty care are important for people to have good health care.
Mm-hmm. And in truth, more medical students are going into specializations, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why is that?
Well, there's several reasons for that. Part of it is that medical students are graduating with really high levels of debt right now from their education, and specialization is much more lucrative generally than primary care practice.
They'll pay off their debts faster.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they're very concerned about that. You know, medical student debt interest rates are higher right now than they were for me or for doctors who graduated 10, 20, 30 years ago, and the amounts are higher as well. And so that's a big concern. Students are really fearful about being able to pay off debt.
Has it become, okay, so is it much more, it's much more common for medical students to pursue a specialization than primary care?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and more and more primary care duties as well are being handled by nurse practitioners and PAs, physician's assistants. How has this affected the landscape?
Well, actually, the shortage is big enough that even as more physician assistants and nurse practitioners are participating in primary care and doing some of the primary care work,
yeah,
there's still a lot more demand than can be met by those groups of professionals.
Are there efforts underway to try to increase the number of students pursuing a primary care medical career?
There are some efforts. There are some new medical schools building in Michigan, and some of those new medical schools, like Central Michigan University, for example, have a real focus on primary care. Certainly we at Michigan State are trying to improve our focus on primary care, encourage students to choose primary care, and we have some programs that really focus on that as well.
Is it dominated? Is the view of medical students dominated then by this financial consideration, or are there other attitudes in play here as well?
Well, there are other issues too. Because there's been so much change and discussion about primary care in the last few years, a lot of students have a feeling that it's kind of a field that's in chaos or in evolution, and they're a little bit fearful about that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly specialization is much more prestigious than primary care is, and you know, so students are attracted to that prestige as well. And there's a feeling, a fear that primary care jobs won't be as secure, although I really personally think that fear is unfounded. I think primary care careers are very secure because there is a lot of demand for primary care.
We're talking with Dr. Julie Phillips, an associate professor of family medicine at MSU's College of Human Medicine, about the anticipated shortage nationwide of primary care physicians. The whole system has become so much more fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about the impact that is having and why that's happening?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. In some ways, I think the biggest problem is the fragmentation. It means that people get care in lots of different places and from lots of different providers, and sometimes communication and care coordination between providers doesn't happen very well. Primary care doctors really see that as part of our central role, and when people don't have primary care or their primary care system is overwhelmed, that task isn't completed as well. And that increases cost because there's more duplication. And when people don't know their providers well, the provider doesn't know their history as much, they tend to order more testing and do things that are more invasive, mm-hmm, because it's harder for them to put it into context, you know, to understand the problem in the sense of the patient's whole history.
Preparing for our visit today, I read a New York Times article from a few months ago, and it got into the issue of internships. There are apparently fewer internships, which means fewer primary care physicians. Would you mind tackling that one and help us understand what's going on there?
Well, so there's been a significant effort to expand medical schools across the country, and also here in Michigan, where we have several new medical schools that are opening.
Central Michigan, you alluded to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's also some schools that have expanded their classes. So we're graduating a lot more medical students. But graduate medical education has not expanded in the same way. Graduate medical education is the years of training that physicians undergo after they've graduated from medical school, where they really perfect their skills and become more experienced.
Right.
And so as we have more medical students graduating, but we don't have graduate medical education programs or residency programs for them, it doesn't allow us to expand that workforce as much as we would like to. So investing more in primary care graduate medical education, like family medicine residency programs, is really a key way that we could strengthen our healthcare workforce.
And where does that investment tend to come from?
That investment comes from Medicare, mostly. Medicare pays for those positions, okay. And they typically are housed in hospitals.
So there's a case to be made to beef that up.
Absolutely.
There's a real irony here in that the Affordable Care Act was meant to expand access, but in truth, is there a chance that it threatens to counter the access to care?
I don't think the Affordable Care Act will counter access to care, but the Affordable Care Act's main focus was on expanding insurance. And there's more to access than just having insurance coverage. So, for example, if someone has insurance coverage, but they don't have any primary care providers in their community who are taking new patients, or they don't have any who take their particular type of insurance, you know, they still won't be able to access that care. And access is also determined by things like having adequate transportation or being able to pay for copays or having a doctor who speaks your language, having a place where you feel comfortable. You know, all those kinds of things play into healthcare access. So sometimes just having insurance isn't enough. And I suspect that even though we've expanded insurance access, in some ways it will make the primary care shortage more evident because more people will be trying to access primary care but won't be able to because there won't be enough providers.
And maybe some of the traffic that we've experienced in emergency rooms, is it possible if the shortage plays out that the traffic to emergency rooms may not go down the way we want it to go down?
Oh, yes.
The way it needs to go down.
People who don't have primary care access absolutely use emergency rooms more.
Right.
Absolutely. And that drives up cost. So investing in primary care can actually lower overall health care spending by decreasing emergency room costs, decreasing costs of hospitalizations, allowing people to get care before problems get worse and they get very sick. And it also improves quality. It reduces mortality, for example, if people have better access to primary care.
We alluded earlier to expanding residency programs, more primary care residency programs. Any other potential solutions that kind of rise to the top for you? Any other measures?
I think efforts to reduce the income disparity between primary care doctors and specialty doctors would really make a big difference. In Canada, they have done a lot of work to try to reduce that disparity and to make
primary care.
Exactly, to incentivize primary care. And that has made a real difference in their workforce, for example.
Very good. And tell us what you're up to at specifically at Michigan State University. You train whom?
Well, I teach medical students, and I also train family doctors at Sparrow Hospital in the residency program.
Okay. Well, we have been discussing the shortage of primary care physicians with our guest, Dr. Julie Phillips. Julie's Associate Professor of Family Medicine at MSU's College of Human Medicine. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Reach us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan Department of Civil Rights is calling for a review of an apparent murder dating back to 1970. The incident, still unsolved, took the life of one of the department's own, its first executive director. Burton Gordon became the first person to lead the then-new Michigan Department of Civil Rights in 1964, Authorities say he died after being shot several times in a downtown Detroit parking structure, an apparent robbery gone wrong. Over the years, the case had gone cold, but our next guest, who is the department's new executive director, is calling on the Michigan State Police to review the case, to talk with us about the Burton Gordon cold case and about his new role at the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. We welcome Director Matt Wiesaw. Welcome to Current State, Matt.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on your appointment.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about Burton Gordon and his early years at the DCR.
Well, as you indicated, Mr. Gordon was the first director of the Department of Civil Rights. He had come from Philadelphia. The commission at that time had done a nationwide search. Mr. Gordon was the executive director of one of the very first civil rights commissions in Pennsylvania. He came over, offices in Detroit, was doing an excellent job in that he was very dedicated to equal protection, equal access for all peoples. Unfortunate incident at the end of one of his days, he walked to his parked car and was unfortunately killed. The homicide remains unsolved to this day. There was a variety, as I understand by reading news reviews, a variety of different motives, but a true motive is not known. It appears that suspects had not been developed, and the case is actually being investigated by the Detroit Police Department.
Oh, okay.
Michigan State Police assisted with some out-of-the-air interviews, again, as I understand, but it is a Detroit Police Department investigation. And I have been in conversation with both the chief and the deputy chief, and I do hope to meet with them after the holidays to ask them to review the case to see if it might meet their criteria for a cold case for another review.
Mr. Gordon was shot March 20th, 1970. What would you ask the authorities to do here then exactly? What's involved in reviewing a case like this?
Well, depending on the evidence that was collected 43 years ago, and with today's new technology, you may or may not know this, but I did a career in the state police. I did 26 years.
Right.
So the evidence, homicide cases are never closed until a conviction or a clearance is made, whether they just have no suspects. So they remain open. There is no statute of limitations. So I would ask if they felt, based on their criteria, and I don't really know what that is, that there was sufficient evidence collected that through the new technology today, they might be able to determine a suspect. Mm-hmm. For example, DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, DNA was not considered. If they had some type of DNA evidence that they had preserved, that could be useful today. If there was a database that matched, they would have a place to start.
Mm. Are you holding out real hope to learn something constructive, or do you feel this is more symbolic? Is this more a reminder to the public of the role Burton Gordon played?
No, I think there's real hope. Again, based on today's technology, the thorough investigation that I'm sure was completed back 40 years ago. It was, like I said, Detroit Police Department, Michigan State Police assisted, and as I read in the newspaper, the Michigan Attorney General's Office assisted. So I think there probably are things there that they could look at and, develop different angles to consider, maybe conduct some additional interviews.
Given all your years in the state police, is it easy to assume this was a robbery gone wrong, or
that would be? I have not looked at the police report. Being an open investigation, that's not a public document, so I really wouldn't have any kind of an opinion if it was robbery or politically motivated or even racially motivated.
I'm curious. What do you know? What Mr. Gordon's descendants think of your suggestion? Are they aware of what you want to do here?
I have not talked with any of the family members. I believe the incoming chair of our commission. I think there is a son still residing in Michigan, and I think we want to be very respectful of his feelings. So I don't know what the conversation has been with him, because I've not talked to him.
As you pointed out, you're a former state police officer yourself, and
yes,
you're the former tribal chairman. Is it the Pokagon, I beg your pardon.
That's
Pokagon,
okay.
Band of Potawatomi Indians. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. How long were you a police officer?
I was an enlisted police officer for 26 years. And upon my retirement, I then spent 7 years working for the Troopers Association as their director of government relations. retired from that again about 2008, and at that point was the chair of the Pokagon Band.
And how long were your tribal chair?
Up until October 28th when I took this job.
Okay. And how did your appointment to the Civil Rights Department unfold exactly?
During their second search for an executive director, I received a couple of phone calls. I had been on the commission 8 years previous. I had been gone for about a year, asking if I was interested in the position. They had talked about some of the issues that they had seen and felt, because I knew several of the current commissioners, that I might have the skill set to help get morale in the department back up. We've got some pretty bad morale through the state surveys.
Why is that?
Well, the department has was without a director for about 8 months. We had some communication issues, from what I understand. Just my opinion now, in traveling the state to all of our offices and in talking with staff, I don't think that our staff really felt that their opinions and their voice was being heard or being considered. And we are a very small department. We should be family, and I'm making sure that everybody realizes their comments, their concerns, their ideas will be heard by the leadership of this department.
Our guest here on Current State is Matt Wiesaw, who is the new executive director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Matt, there's an effort in the Lansing area among local governments to recognize the rights of the area's lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender residents. Do you support that effort?
Yes. Yes, okay. Support that. The commission has been on record for probably 30 years of adding an amendment to the Elliott-Larsen Act to protect free access for the LGBT community. Absolutely.
Now, you told Tim Skubick recently that you support the larger goals of the state Civil Rights Commission, but he wrote that you were hesitant to confirm whether you're personally supportive of gay marriage. Can you clarify that?
No, actually, Mark, I thought that was pretty clear. My comment to Tim was my personal feelings on that particular topic are not important. I'm not going to lead this department based on my personal feelings. I will follow the direction of the commission. And like I explained to Tim, the commission has been, you know, on record for 30 years supporting protections for the gay, lesbian, transgender community in the Elliott-Larsen Act. We will continue to do that.
Now, there's an ongoing debate over Indian mascots for schools and sports teams. I have to ask you about that.
Sure. Happy to talk about that one. The department did, I believe, excellent research in Native imagery, not the mascot, but Native imagery, in respect to hostile learning environments for children in the elementary schools. That's what the investigation, their research was on. That's what the complaint was filed on. I think the research was spot on. If I would have been there, I think we would have handled it just a little bit differently. There would have been a little more communication. And quite honestly, in talking with the other tribal leaders on this topic, this really is an issue that the tribe should take the lead on. I appreciate what the department did. The research is fabulous. But I think it's the tribe's responsibility, because you have a very unique situation in this state where many of the tribes have worked with the schools in their areas and have designed or approved the imagery.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in our service area in the southwest corner of the state, my aunt was in the group that named the Hartford Indians. We had a council person.
The Hartford?
Hartford. Okay. Hartford Indians.
Okay.
We had council people work on the design for the Dowagiac Chieftains. And we also had a tribal citizen who worked on the design for the Pawpaw Redskins. So that created a lot of conversation in our community. Now, personally, I don't think there's too much debate that the Redskins, that name needs to go. That is derogatory. There's nothing honorable about that term. The other ones, quite honestly, I think they're decisions that individual tribal leaders, tribal governments have to make in with consultation with the communities that they're in.
Are you suggesting that there's a variety of opinion among tribal governments with regard to these issues?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No question.
Does that break down along age lines? Do you have any insight into that?
Yes and no. It depends on the community and how involved they were. It does break down because in the cases that I just referred to with respect to our community, those were some more senior folks that were involved in that. The issue that we really need to look at, while we value our relationships with the communities, we have to look at the research and pay particular attention to the validated comments that the native imagery does create hostile learning environments for the young people. And, you know, our future is kids across the board. That's very important. And I think there's a responsibility on behalf of the tribes to really take a serious look at that, we are.
It's interesting to watch this because locally you see all kinds of communities that grow very attached to the imagery, attached to their schools and their sports teams, and they really go into defensive mode on these things. It's a fascinating topic. It's been quite a year for the Department of Civil Rights in Michigan. I know you launched an effort to visit all the different parts of the state with your personnel here on the anniversary of the Michigan Civil Rights
50
Department.
Years. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You put in a lot of miles since October?
Members of the staff have put in a lot of miles.
Okay.
My miles have actually gone down quite a bit. I live in this area, have for 30 years, and I drove every day back to Dowagiac. So my round trip to my previous office was 250 miles. Now I drive 15 round trip. So my miles have been reduced quite a bit.
Okay.
But the 50 city tour was a great initiative that was started before I got on board.
Michigan had one of the most progressive approaches to civil rights. Here, the Civil Rights Commission back in 1963, part of the new state constitution. So real cutting edge in that respect.
Yeah, we still are the only state that has the Civil Rights Commission in the Constitution.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your time here today. Matt Wiesaw is the recently appointed director of the Michigan Department of Civil Rights. Matt, good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Just a little bit of shop talk here. WKAR wants to offer its condolences to the friends and family of Larry Eslak, who died early Monday. There are few, if any, radio or TV people in this area, few around the state, really, who don't have a debt to Larry Eslak, primarily a technical debt. He was one of the most competent and incredibly involved broadcast engineers you will ever meet. He really left quite a footprint, not just here in Lansing, which was really, I mean, he was based here in Lansing, but he did work all over the state for radio and TV and for the larger broadcasting industry. Larry died of cancer early on Monday. There's a new mental health resource for Michigan personnel and their families, and Michigan is at the forefront of the effort. It's called STAR Behavioral Health Providers. Specialized training is being given to behavioral health professionals so they can better assess and counsel servicemen and women. Michigan was the second state to get a grant to establish the program, which started just in April. One wave of training has now been completed. Michigan Project Coordinator Paul Lepley is based at Michigan State University. He's a mental health therapist who served in Afghanistan. Paul, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And Dan Zomerly is a PhD student in human development and family studies at MSU. He's gone through all three tiers of the training. Dan, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having us.
And they're joining us to fill us in on the STAR Behavioral Health Providers Program. We hear a lot about the mental health needs of American military personnel and veterans, and that often those needs are not being adequately met. The suicide rate's extraordinarily high. Is that the thing that the STAR Behavioral Health Providers Program will address?
That's just part of it. Mental health in general is really what we hope to address. There's so many service members that come back from deployments with mental health problems, and yet for them to get services, there's a very inherent disconnect between the service members and the providers that they would actually provide the mm-hmm. service to them.
Paul, tell us about your service. I know you were in Afghanistan.
Yes, I'm with the 126th Cavalry Regiment, stationed out of Wyoming, Michigan, and I have one tour to Afghanistan where I acted as a chaplain for a squadron. And yeah, it was quite amazing to just go through that whole process of getting ready to go overseas, being overseas, and then coming home. And then not only what I went through, but the journey that my family had to take too.
How's that?
Well, each service member has roughly 1.5 dependents. So we look at a deployment and we think of the service member alone, when in fact there's a much larger group of people being affected by that deployment. So I have a wife and 3 kids that were affected by me being away. And so for me to listen to what they were going through and not to really be physically present to help them out through those issues as a husband and as a father, that was very difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Describe for us your actual service in Afghanistan, though. There were a lot of infantry men and women to counsel?
Yes, yep. One of the issues that the military seems to be facing is, with chaplains in particular, is when they send a group over, they'll oftentimes pare down that group. And when they pare down that group, they lose the slot for a chaplain. My squadron commander, Colonel Tellier, was smart enough to say, you know what, we should probably have a chaplain with a small group that's going over. And so we got over there, and it turns out that there's a bunch of these small groups over there that we got chaplains paired off. And so instead of providing ministry support for the group that I was originally intended to, I ended up providing ministry support for a much larger demographic of individuals than I thought. And that was across all branches of the military.
And Dan Zomerly, tell us about your training here in the STAR Behavioral Health Providers Program. You've completed it.
Correct. Yeah. So the training has 3 tiers to it. The first tier involves kind of an acculturation, training civilian practitioners like myself about the language of military, about certain experiences that are specific to the men and women who serve. The second tier then looks at some specific issues, such as you mentioned suicidality, that was covered, traumatic brain injury, depression, insomnia, some of the more common issues that service men and women have to deal with when they come back from their tours of duty. And then the final tier is a specific evidence-based training. The one I attended is called cognitive processing therapy, and that is specific to post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And so clinicians like myself, people across Michigan, civilian practitioners, learning about specific interventions to address the unique challenges and needs that servicemen and women face when they come back from their deployments.
And where are you right now, Dan? Are you working with veterans actively now, or will you be stepping that up into the future?
I hope to step that up in the future. I'm still finishing my PhD program, and I have a limited license as a marriage and family therapist in the state. So I do still see families. Currently, I have a lot of clients who are family members of either like a sibling or relative of someone who is serving actively currently. I hope in the future to step up that service to men and women who are active duty or reserve members.
We certainly wish you luck on this. Paul, are there any treatment successes you can point to at this stage of the game, or is it still too early?
What do you mean by treatment successes?
Well, working with Michigan veterans, let's say, graduates of this program, working with Michigan veterans.
Yes, we can actually, part of our website has 2 sites. So it has a provider side, which a mental health provider can go to and apply to training, see what the training is about. The other side is for the service members and their families to go to. And we can actually track how many hits we have, which general areas they are. And I get phone calls from different people within the National Guard saying, hey, I got this service member who's looking for services. Can you help us out? And so I can then better direct that service member to a provider who's received the specialized training, which then helps decrease the barriers between the service member and the provider.
Dan, can you talk to us about learning, trying to acclimate yourself to the experience of a veteran, of an infantry person who has really seen violent action in Afghanistan for example, a PTSD
sure.
Patient. What is it like acclimating to that mindset?
Mm-hmm. A lot of it is there's a concept of informed not knowing as a therapist. There's this idea of you do good work when you are informed about the experiences of the people that you work with, mm-hmm. But also coming from a place of curiosity and asking questions to learn about the specifics of their experience. And that's been my learning with the training regarding military members and their families of using this training that STAR Behavioral Health is providing as a way to be more informed about the language, about the culture, about the experiences specific to service, and in that process of asking questions specifically about the specific experiences of each of the military men and women that I might meet with.
Paul, is it common for veterans to resist assistance like this?
Yes, sir. As a chaplain, I'm usually one of the first points of contact with a service member when they have an issue. The commander usually says, hey, chaplain, you need to talk to this individual. I say, roger that, and I go talk to that individual. And before we left, of all the individuals I talked to, about 9 out of 10, during the course of maybe an hour that I had with them, when it became evident that they needed further help, I'd be like, you know, you probably should get some services from another mental health provider outside of the military, somebody in your own community. And 9 out of 10 times, that service member would, their shoulders would sag, their head would drop, and they'd get this really defeated sound in their voice, and they'd say, chaplain, I tried that, but they just didn't get it.
And that is really what this program aims to correct.
Yes, sir.
Is that right? Why was Michigan so early for this program? Is the need greater in Michigan?
Well, Michigan has, if my stats are not mistaken, the 7th highest veteran population with no active duty component here. We have about 690,000 veterans in the state of Michigan as of 2012. So that's a very large demographic of individuals that need help, that there's potentially a disconnect between them and the service providers. Also, with why we're so early to adopt the program is we are called a beta state, so we're a second state to adopt the program. Primarily because of Dr. Adrian Blows, he's the director of the program, his connection with the Military Family Research Institute out of Purdue University. Mm-hmm. And so he heard about it, and he's done a lot of studies, a lot of research on military and military families. And he wanted to just kind of spearhead this and see if we can replicate what they did in Indiana and Purdue before it goes nationally, because there is a chance that this program will go nationally here in the next few years.
You mentioned the importance of the family dynamic, that each veteran on the average has, what, 1.5 other family members. Do family members ever require different kinds of assistance than the veteran, him or herself?
That's a great question, and a lot of it depends on what the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
One nice thing, when you get deployed, usually your income goes up a fairly substantial amount, and oftentimes veterans really look forward to those deployments. But I'll never forget my wife saying, you know, you value this deployment more than you value us. You are here physically, this is as we're getting ready to go, but you're not here mentally. And so me looking forward to a deployment, my wife dreading it, was a very interesting dichotomy to reconcile between the two of us. And then along the way, I got my wife on board with the deployment saying, honey, when I get that mid-tour leave, we can meet in Paris. And she was all for that. And then all of a sudden, as we got just January 1st of 2012, the Army changed its policy to 9-month deployments, which is about 260 days. You need like 270 days, roughly, to get the mid-tour deployment. So we lost all mid-tour deployments, and then my wife was just kind of down and out.
Are we arguably playing serious catch-up when it comes to assisting Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans?
I'd say so. It seems like from what veterans have reported to me, that there's a backlog within the VA system. I had a provider who has a son who has pretty severe PTSD, who had an episode about 2 months ago. And through this episode, the provider tried to take his son to the VA to get in-resident treatment because his son was suicidal. And when he got there, the VA wasn't able to serve him because their beds were full. And so what's that father-in-law supposed to do with his son or his son-in-law who's really needing help but can't get it right then and there when he needs mm-hmm. it? And so then that family had to rely upon local services that were available.
Dan, what are you looking forward to most in your role as a counselor of service veterans?
to be helpful and to break down that barrier of service or treatment to the servicemen and women that Paul talked about, the shrugged shoulders of you said they just don't get it. I look forward to people like myself, other mental health professionals getting it and learning more about the unique needs to military families and for myself to get it and to break down that barrier and increase the comfort level of servicemen and women with finding treatment in people like me, other counselors out there, civilian counselors even, where they can feel confident that we do understand their challenges and their needs.
Has being through the STAR Behavioral Health Provider Program, has that really altered how you view veterans and their needs?
I don't know if it's dramatically altered. I had a great deal.
You did have a mental health background before you embarked in this.
Yeah, so a lot of the specific diagnoses familiar with, but not specific to how those symptoms maybe play out or are shown in servicemen and women. And so it has improved my understanding of what to look for, questions to ask, and even interventions that maybe can be most helpful to military families.
We want to thank both of you for joining us today, and we wish you both the best of luck. We've been talking about the STAR Behavioral Health Providers. Our guests have been the Michigan Project Coordinator, Paul Lepley, who's based here at MSU, mental health therapist, and Dan Zomerle, a PhD student in Human Development and Family Studies at MSU, and the topic has been the STAR Behavioral Health Providers. Thanks much, and good luck.
Thank you, sir.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It's Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the Lansing area community a better place. Today, during this festive holiday season, we feature the R.J. Scheffel Memorial Toy Project. The group handcrafts thousands of wooden toys each year for local kids. And here in the Current State studio to tell us more about the toy project, Operations Manager Larry Koster. Welcome, Larry.
Thank you.
Tell us about the R.J. Scheffel Toy Project. Who is R.J. Scheffel?
R.J. Scheffel was a retired grocer here in Lansing, and he built toys in his home, in his basement, prior to the 70s, because he died in the summers in 1970s. I'm not sure the exact year, and he was 90 years old at that time.
And he had done this for many, many years?
Yeah, I have no idea how many.
Yeah.
I can't tell you that. That's way before my time.
Well, obviously, he created quite an organization that's managed to 40-some years, and the thing is still alive after Mr. Scheffel passed away. What do you tell us about what you folks do exactly?
Well, we're a group of seniors. We're all probably 60 and above. We have a couple that are in their mid-80s. A couple of years ago, we had one gentleman that was 100 years old, but he passed away a year ago, I think it was. We have a very diverse group of backgrounds. We have like four different kinds of engineers, civil engineers, chassis engineer. We even have a couple that we call mind engineers. They're psychologists. One is from the MSU. Another one was up at Baker College in Owosso and Flint.
But they're all woodworkers, basically.
Yeah, right, right.
How does this toy-making process work? Well, who designs what you make?
Well, there's a few things that even Scheffel had, but each year somebody comes up with a different toy, a different different design, and we incorporate that into what we make. We make about 45 different toys.
And how often do you guys get together? I mean,
okay,
you
yes.
work individually. How many people do you have making toys right now?
We have probably close to 30 volunteers, but some are Monday people, some are Wednesday people, and some are Friday people. We work 8 to 11:30 Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
Is Christmas the focal point of your season, are you at this all year round?
Not necessarily. The Salvation Army probably is the only one that is directly involved with Christmas toys. We make things for three departments at Sparrow Hospital, the pediatric emergency room, the child life playroom. This is where kids are in the hospital. They can leave their room and go to this area, and they paint up what we make.
Oh, okay.
And then there's also a pediatric subspecialty clinic. They get the toys. So between the three departments, they probably get 20% of what we make. And prior to this year, we've made more than 9,000 toys a year.
That's incredible for the number.
It is. Last year in 2012, it was over 10,000 toys. This year, we had requests for 9,300 toys, but we had a fire July 30th. So essentially, we've been shut down since then, but we did get out 6,000 toys, even though we had the fire. And
Are you looking for a new space then?
Oh, or? Okay. We just moved in to a new location. We just finished this up, you might say, this week. We had to empty the boxes, you know, and get organized for the placement of the machinery and all that kind of thing.
Is there a story that comes to mind that exemplifies why you do this work? How often do you see the kids actually playing with the toys?
Probably the only time where I was directly involved with kids getting toys was at the VFW National Home down at Eaton Rapids, and I've been there a number of times. They get probably 100 toys a year, but this last year, this gal, her name is Joanne Murphy down there, picked up her toys. I said, "Is there anything else you need?" And she said, "Well, we'd like some stick horses." It's a horse head with a handle. And so I said, "Well, how many would you like?" And she said, "Well, I'll take 14. I said, "What color do you want?" I said, "I want every color." So we made that. We went down there. And the kids just came up from their morning nap. And it was amazing for me, for the kids to grab the boy colors and the girls grab the girl colors. I couldn't believe it. This is little toddlers, really, maybe 2 to 3 years old. And that's the only time I've seen kids actually get our toys.
Still sounds pretty gratifying, though.
Yeah.
You right there.
Right.
There are so many more electronic toys these days, though. It pops into my head. Are the kids that enjoy the wooden toys, they tend to be younger, I imagine, in part because of all of the electronic toys that are out there now.
Essentially, what we make is for 8 years and under.
Yeah.
So,
where does your funding come from?
We operate strictly on donations.
Okay.
The community is real good to us. Jackson National Life has been very generous. The Granger Foundation is generous. The Rotary Club of Lansing has been very generous. And we get a lot of donations, probably in the $25 to $50 range from individuals.
Have you been in greater need of donations since the fire because of finding a new location? Or?
Yeah, we took in quite a bit after the fire. I think it was close to $10,000 that came in just from the general public.
Okay. Now, do you enlist other volunteers, or do you strictly work with people who actually make toys? Are there other volunteers involved in your organization who are not involved in actually making toys?
Well, there's outside. There's a lady, I don't know her name right off the bat, but she makes quilts for the cradles and beds we make. And what she's done, she's taken the bed quilts right to the Salvation Army Distribution Center, and she fastens the quilt to the beds and cradles.
How long does it take to you mentioned you make thousands of toys every year. That is,
well, we were supposed to make almost 9,000 or more than 9,000 this year. We serve probably 25 agencies, and they'll tell us here in early January what they want. And then we batch the jobs for everybody because we can't jump back and forth. For example, we make cradles, then it might be a step stool, then it might be all sorts of things. But
Well, we want to thank you for joining us today. The R.J. Scheffel toy product, boy, decades after the passing of R.J. Scheffel, still alive and well and making wooden toys for kids all over the Lansing area. Larry Koster is the operations manager for the R.J. Scheffel Memorial Toy Project. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Good luck. We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing excellent work. And we just need to know about them. So let us know. Please help us out. Send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, it's time for Year in Review, Month in Review. Kathy Gray of the Detroit Free Press and Jonathan Osting of MLive join us. We also preview the Lansing Symphony Orchestra's holiday concert. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. We want to leave you today on a figure skating note. Five of Mid-Michigan's finest figure skaters will soon be on their way to the National U.S. Figure Skating Championship. The week-long event begins January 5th in Boston. Our local competitors are Hannah Miller, Yvonne Mohoff, Sam Parks, and sisters Devin and Maeve Pasco, ranging in age from 14 to 17, but many are seasoned competitors. Suburban Ice Rink in East Lansing held a send-off party for the group this week. Current State's Kevin Lavery came to watch their routines and files this audio postcard.
All right, I am Sam Parks.
Hi, I'm Devin Pasco.
Devin, what's the hardest part of your routine?
Probably just having the stamina and getting those elements in at the end.
The most rewarding part is winning, and the thing I'm most concerned about is, like, in pairs it's almost kind of worse if you, like, mess up, because it's like it's not just you that's affected, it's both of you, so it's like more pressure for me.
Well, I'm just really excited to go to Boston. I've never been to Boston before, and I just have to do my best.
I am Yvonne Mohoff. I went to a couple of times to junior nationals before this, but this is my second time going to nationals.
Nervous about going to Boston?
No. I feel really confident. I feel really good. Yeah.
Hi, this is Hannah Miller. This is going to be my fourth time going to nationals. I think that this year is going to be a lot more excited because it's Olympic year, so all the media is going to be there. I think that I'm more prepared this year because I have three nationals under my belt, so I know what to expect and I know what I'm going into, so I'm just excited.
I'm Maeve Pasco.
You're skating with a partner. Remind me who that is.
Micah Jaffe. He's not here, which is why we're not skating. He lives in Cleveland, and I live here in East Lansing, so it's a bit of a commute, but that's why we can't always be in the same place at the same time. I really like our routine this year. We're skating to Man in the Iron Mask, and it's really cool doing a period piece because it's kind of Three Musketeers time, and it's really interesting because I've never done anything like this before, and I feel like we're really prepared, and we'll just go out there and give it all we've got.